So, when you think about just having absolute unbreakable
Right,
focus,
like prepping for a massive presentation or something.
yeah, exactly. Or, being deep in meditation, or even just stepping up to the free throw line, there's usually this assumption that you need dead
Oh,
silence.
for sure. We're totally conditioned to treat focus like we're in a library.
Right. Any noise is treated like a threat to your concentration. And the ultimate picture of like mental discipline is just complete and total stillness.
Which, I mean, it makes intuitive sense. You picture a perfectly silent mind that's completely sealed off from the outside world.
But when you look at the intersection of ancient Jewish law and modern cognitive psychology, that pristine silent room actually isn't the ideal environment for the human brain at all.
Not even close, yeah.
Which kind of brings us to the core question we are exploring in our deep dive today. When you are focusing, intensely praying, meditating, whatever, should you be completely silent or should you be whispering to yourself?
And, on the surface, that sounds like a really mundane question about, well, volume control.
Right, just turning the dial down.
Exactly. But the debate over how loud a prayer or a focused thought should be is actually incredibly
It
complex.
really is. And today, we are looking at this through a fascinating stack of texts. We're tracking this fierce, like, historical and theological debate over the exact volume of prayer.
Spanning centuries, really.
Yeah, moving from ancient biblical stories to Talmudic rulings straight into modern cognitive psychology. And the centerpiece of this whole thing is a highly charged, fiery, polemical
Oh,
essay.
fiery is putting it mildly.
Seriously, it launches this full-scale attack on mystical Kabbalistic texts over this exact issue. So our mission today is to explore the psychology of the spoken word, unpack these strict ancient rules of whispering, and understand why a simple disagreement over volume escalated into a bitter battle over the very soul of a religion.
And just to set the stage properly for you listening, it is really worth noting the tone of the primary essay we're analyzing today.
We need a quick disclaimer here.
Right. The author is intensely opinionated. I mean, they use extremely harsh, combative language against certain mystical texts, specifically the Zohar. So, as always, we're just navigating this as neutral guides.
Exactly. We aren't taking sides or endorsing any religious viewpoints, whether it's the traditionalists or the mystics.
Yeah, we're simply here to unpack the arguments and the historical friction contained in the text.
Right, we're just looking at the mechanics of the debate. And this whole debate finds its grounding in a pretty famous biblical precedent, right?
Yeah, the story of Hannah from the book of Samuel.
Right. So she is desperate for a child, and she's in the temple praying with such intense emotion that Eli, the high priest, actually thinks she's drunk.
Which is quite the assumption to make in a temple.
I know, right? But the text gives a very specific reason for his confusion. It says, only her lips were moving and her voice was not heard.
And that line brings up this brilliant linguistic nuance that the author of our primary text highlights.
Oh, the Hebrew phrasing, yeah.
Exactly. In the original Hebrew, the phrasing is hyper-specific. It says her voice was not heard by others. The word used is yishama.
Meaning like external hearing.
Right. But the grammatical structure strongly implies that the voice was heard by herself.
Wow. Okay. So she wasn't actually perfectly silent.
No, not at all. She was moving her lips, actively generating just enough sound to reach her own ears.
Okay, wait. I'm hung up on one thing here.
Sure, what is it?
If the ultimate goal is connecting with an omniscient God who already knows exactly what you're thinking anyway, wouldn't a purely silent internal thought be considered like the highest, purest form of focus? I mean, why force it into physical sound at all?
See, that is the logical assumption. That's what most people would think.
Right.
But the ancient sages, and surprisingly enough, modern cognitive psychologists, completely disagree with that premise.
Really? Modern psychology gets involved
Oh,
here.
absolutely. The author connects this ancient story of Hannah directly to a psychological mechanism known as the production effect.
The production effect. Okay, meaning because you aren't just thinking the thought. Right.
You're forcing your brain to translate the thought into motor function.
To literally move your mouth.
Yes, to move the muscles, and then your auditory cortex actually has to process the sound coming back in.
Oh, wow. So you're trapping your brain in this loop of focus.
You're engaging multiple systems simultaneously, exactly. There's actually a prominent 2018 study cited in the text, which proves that information spoken aloud and heard in your own voice is retained and processed significantly better than information you just read or think silently.
Because it's multi-sensory encoding.
Precisely. When you generate a word physically, it makes it distinct in your memory. And the historical corroboration for this is just striking.
Who figured this out back then?
The great 12th century philosopher Maimonides. He ruled that studying out loud actively cements learning in the mind, while silent reading inevitably leads to forgetting.
Wow. So Maimonides knew about the production effect centuries before cognitive psychologists named it.
He absolutely did. He understood that the working memory just doesn't hold on to silent text as effectively. So looking back at Hannah, she wasn't whispering just to hide her prayer from Eli.
Oh, I see. She was whispering to psychologically anchor herself.
Exactly. She was utilizing her own voice to maintain absolute, unbroken focus on her intention and to keep her mind from wandering.
Which perfectly sets up this incredibly vivid analogy that the ancient sages used. They wanted to describe exactly how loud that whisper should be.
Yeah, the Hebrew word they used for the ideal volume of prayer is marchish.
Marchish. And the author traces the root of this word back to the book of Leviticus, specifically to the word marchishet, which translates to a frying pan.
It is such an evocative linguistic connection, honestly.
It's brilliant because, you know, if you think about it like cooking or even like white noise, it makes perfect sense.
Most so.
Well, if a room is dead silent, every single intrusive thought or like a tiny creak of the floorboards, it echoes in your brain and distracts you.
Right, the library problem.
Exactly. And on the other extreme, if there's a roaring fire or a loud TV, you can't hear yourself think at all.
It's overwhelming.
But the gentle, quiet sizzle of a frying pan, it occupies just enough of your brain's background processing power that the rest of your mind is completely free to lock into the present moment.
That is exactly it. The frying pan sizzle is the optimal acoustic environment for the human mind. And based on this psychological reality, Talmudic scholars actually mapped out a highly structured, logical system for the volume of prayer.
They codified it.
They really did. They broke it down into 5 distinct tiers.
Okay, let's walk through those. What's tier 1?
Tier 1 is pure silent thought, literally in the heart only, with 0 lip movement.
And what's the verdict on that?
According to the ancient rules, this actually does not fulfill the obligation of prayer.
Wait, really? It doesn't count.
It doesn't count. The multisensory cognitive engagement just isn't there.
Wow. Okay, so tier 2.
Tier 2 is mouthing the words without hearing them.
So lip reading volume.
Right. Now, this is forbidden ideally, but if you've already done it, it's accepted post facto.
Okay, so it passes, but barely. What about tier 3?
Tier 3 is whispering so only you can hear. This is the gold standard.
Ah, the frying pan sizzle.
Exactly. This is the ideal. You hear yourself, but the person standing shoulder to shoulder with you hears absolutely nothing.
The perfect equilibrium of focus. I love that. So what happens if you go louder? Tier 4.
Tier 4 is making it audible to others. Now, this is acceptable only if you are completely alone and you are genuinely struggling to focus.
Like your mind is racing and you need to reel it back in.
Exactly. You might need a little extra volume to grab your own attention.
Yeah.
But it is strictly forbidden if you are in a congregation.
Because the moment you raise your volume, your personal focus tool becomes someone else's distraction.
Precisely. You're ruining their frying pan sizzle.
That makes total sense. And the last one, tier 5.
Tier 5 is yelling. And this is completely, absolutely forbidden across the board.
And the rationale behind the ban on yelling is fascinating because it goes way beyond just being disruptive to other people.
Yeah, it becomes a theological issue.
Right. The Talmud compares yelling in prayer to the behavior of false prophets, specifically pointing to the prophets of Baal from the biblical narratives.
Yes, because yelling implies a fundamental theological flaw. It implies a lack of faith.
Like you think God is far away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's as if the person believes the divine presence is deaf or incredibly distant and needs to be shouted at just to pay attention.
Like the ancient idol worshippers, right? They would scream and dance and cut themselves to get their God's attention.
Exactly. The sages wanted to distance the practice from that performative frenzy entirely. The whisper represents an intimate, immediate connection.
You know, think about how this applies to your own mindfulness routine or daily stress.
Oh, it's incredibly relevant.
Right. If you've just walked through the door after a nightmare commute, your brain is entirely hijacked. Your stress levels are spiking.
You're not in the right headspace.
Not at all. And the text points out that Maimonides actually ruled that if a traveler arrives home tired or distressed, it is legally forbidden for them to pray.
Not just unadvised forbidden.
Forbidden. They are instructed to wait up to 3 days for their mind to settle and their anxiety to cool off before attempting to engage spiritually.
Which really shows a profound respect for human psychology. The sages understood that intention and focus are paramount.
Right. The volume control, the whispering, that frying pan sizzle, it's just a mechanism to facilitate inner focus.
That's a tool.
Exactly. And if that inner focus is completely shattered by physical exhaustion or mental distress, the tool is useless. You have to fix the mind before you can use the voice.
It's so practical. But, you know, to understand why this logical, psychologically grounded system eventually exploded into a massive theological conflict.
The fiery polemic we mentioned at the start.
Right. To understand that, we have to look at another foundational concept in Jewish law, personal agency.
The law of the emissary.
Yes. In ancient Jewish jurisprudence, there is this core principle that a person's emissary is like the person themselves.
Meaning you can appoint a proxy.
Exactly. Legally, you can appoint a proxy to sign a business contract, deliver a bill of divorce, or manage your property. And your proxy's action is legally binding as your own.
Okay, makes sense. But the author emphasizes that when it comes to performing a good deed, a mitzvah executing it yourself is always spiritually superior to outsourcing it, right?
Always.
Yeah.
And there is a massive exception to this rule of proxy, specifically regarding ancient animal sacrifices.
This is a crucial piece of the puzzle.
It really is. So when an individual brought a sacrifice to the temple, the owner was required to perform a ritual called samika.
Leaning the hands.
Right. The owner had to physically lean their hands, with all their body weight, onto the head of the animal before it was offered. And the law states clearly that this specific act of leaning could never be delegated.
Never.
Never. You could not hire an emissary. You could not send your employee. You couldn't even have your spouse do it on your behalf.
Because you can't outsource your own cognitive encoding.
Exactly.
The physical act was designed to humble the individual's heart. If someone else leans on the animal, their brain might process the weight and the solemnity of the moment, but yours doesn't.
Right. The physical action is the necessary bridge connecting the physical body to the spiritual intention.
It's the production effect applied to physical action.
That's a great way to put it. You have to produce the action to internalize the result. Whether it's leaning your hands with your own weight or moving your own lips to hear your own whisper, the agency must be yours.
Which makes the historical plot twist coming up so jarring.
Oh, it's a massive left turn.
Right. So we have this beautifully constructed system of psychology and agency codified by a man named Joseph Caro.
The 16th century author of the Shulchan Aruch.
Yes. And the Shulchan Aruch is the definitive master code of Jewish law. He spent 42 years compiling it.
A lifetime of work.
And based on everything we have covered so far, the precedent of Hannah, the Talmudic rulings, the psychology of Maimonides Caro ruled definitively. You must move your lips and you must hear your own whisper.
He essentially made the frying pan sizzle the undeniable law of the land.
But then, and this is wild, in a later addendum to his own work called the Bedek Habayit, Caro completely flips his ruling.
Just reverses it entirely.
Yeah. He writes that actually one should defer to a mystical Kabbalistic text called the Zohar. And the Zohar forbids making any sound at all during prayer. It demands absolute dead silence.
It's a theological earthquake.
It really is. So why did he change his mind?
Well, the author of our text unpacks the Zohar's rationale for this demand. And it is a massive departure from the psychological framework we've been discussing. The Zohar argues for complete silence based on two primary mystical concepts.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is the fear of demonic eavesdropping.
Spiritual espionage.
Exactly. The Zohar posits that if you make an audible sound during your most elevated prayers, the other side, which refers to demonic or external negative forces, often called the Sitra Achra, might hear you.
And if they hear you.
If these forces hear your prayer, they become jealous of its spiritual power. They act as parasitic entities that will intercept the prayer, corrupt its energy, or completely ruin it before it can reach the upper worlds.
Wow.
Yeah. And this perspective was later heavily championed by prominent Kabbalists like the Benish Chai.
So the whisper isn't a tool for focus anymore. It's a security breach.
That's exactly how they saw it.
If you speak, the enemy intercepts the transmission. That is wild. What's the second reason?
The second reason is even more cosmic. It revolves around divine matchmaking.
Matchmaking.
Yeah. The Zohar views the universe as a highly complex system of divine manifestations, or faces of God. It describes prayer as the mechanism used to unite these divine entities.
Okay, how so?
Specifically, it aims to unite a masculine entity described as short face, or Zir Anpin, with a feminine entity known as the Nukva, or Malchut.
Wait, short face.
Yeah, it's a literal translation of the Aramaic term representing a specific divine manifestation.
Okay, so they viewed the universe almost like a massive, intricate machine of masculine and feminine gears that need to perfectly align for divine energy to flow.
That's a perfect analogy.
And in this framework, a human voice is essentially throwing a wrench into those gears.
Precisely. It is seen as a harsh, earthly interference that disrupts a delicate cosmic alignment.
It's a complete paradigm shift. It transforms prayer from being a psychological exercise for human betterment into a magical formula for cosmic mechanics.
And that fundamental shift is exactly what triggers the ferocious backlash from traditionalists.
Because the rationalists looked at this mystical takeover of the law and absolutely revolted.
They were not having it.
Not at all. Which brings us back to our primary text, this modern-day scorcher of an essay attacking this exact Kabbalistic shift. The author is incensed.
The tone is dripping with outrage, honestly. The author argues that the Zohar fundamentally contradicts the Bible, contradicts the Talmud, and contradicts the rational philosophy of Maimonides.
The text does not mince words at all.
No, the author refers to the teachings of the Zohar as Christian Kabbalah.
Wow.
Yeah. Labels it as literal idolatry and describes it as a disease that infected and ruined the pure, rational soul of the religion.
Those are staggering accusations to hurl at revered texts. Just staggering. And the author doesn't just attack the philosophy, right?
Right.
There is a highly specific, explosive, historical accusation of forgery here.
Yes, there is. The author claims that the early Kabbalists did not just promote new mystical ideas, they actively forged and altered ancient texts to legitimize their views.
Like they rewrote history.
Essentially, yeah. For example, the author points to ancient legal texts like the Tosefta, claiming that Kabbalists retroactively inserted phrases like to his ears or deliberately removed certain words.
Just to make it look like the ancient rabbis had always supported their new mystical rule of silence.
Exactly. The author views this as deliberate, cynical corruption of historical truth.
So synthesizing all of this, what is the core philosophical clash here? I mean, why is this author willing to go to war over the volume of a whisper?
It really comes down to the fundamental purpose of human agency.
How do you mean?
For the author, prayer is an exercise in human humility. It's a psychological tool designed to connect a flawed physical human being to God. The whisper, the physical movement of the lips, and the sound hitting the ear is the necessary bridge that facilitates that psychological connection.
It keeps the human grounded.
Exactly. But in the author's view, the Zohar turns prayer into a magical mechanism used to manipulate divine beings and hide from demons.
Right, the espionage and the matchmaking.
Right. The author sees this Kabbalistic approach as stripping humans of their agency and their rational minds. In this mystical view, humans are reduced to little more than cosmic batteries.
Just silently powering the upper world.
Yes. Rather than autonomous individuals doing the hard psychological work of self-improvement.
It really is a battle over the soul of the practice.
It absolutely is.
You know, stepping back and looking at the whole picture, it is just marvelously surprising how a seemingly simple instruction like, how loudly should you pray, contains such multitudes.
It's a massive rabbit hole.
It is. It bridges an ancient biblical story of a woman desperate for a child to modern cognitive psychology, mapping how the brain retains memory through the production effect, all the way to an intense centuries-old theological war between practical tradition and mystical cosmology.
It perfectly illustrates how even the smallest ritual detail is usually tethered to a massive underlying philosophy about how the universe actually works.
Absolutely. So the next time you are trying to get your mind to settle down, whether you are meditating, preparing for a high-stakes meeting, or just trying to process your day, think about the production effect.
Use your voice.
Yeah, think about the power of your own voice to center your racing mind.
Mm-hmm.
Don't force yourself into absolute library silence if it just isn't working. Try to find your own frying pan sizzle of background focus.
And I'd like to leave you with one final thought to ponder that builds on the tension we've explored today.
Oh, please do.
So we have talked extensively about the cognitive benefits of speaking your thoughts out loud, of actively owning your voice and engaging your senses.
Right.
But consider the Zohar's deep, abiding fear of being overheard by negative forces. We live in a modern age that is basically characterized by constant oversharing.
Oh, for sure. Social media everywhere.
Exactly. We broadcast our goals, our daily routines, our anxieties, and our inner lives to the public all the time. So is there, perhaps, a hidden psychological value in the Zohar's approach? is there immense power in keeping our deepest, most important intentions completely silent and hidden from the external forces of public opinion and judgment.
Wow, that's a really profound question. Something for you to mull over the next time you find yourself seeking that perfect, untouched silence or that quiet, gentle sizzle.